Welcome everybody to Between the Lines, the podcast from Jewish Quest. My name is Simon Eder, and each week I'm joined by a special guest who helps us deconstruct that week's parasha, exploring new insights and meaning in the Torah. And this week it is wonderful to have with us from LA, Professor Rabbi Joshua Garraway, who is the Sol and Arlene Bronstein Professor of Judeo-Christian Studies at HUC JIR in Los Angeles. He holds a PhD from the Religious Studies Department at Yale and has ordination from HUC JIR in Cincinnati. And he's also the author of The Beginning of the Gospel, Paul, Philippi, and the Origins of Christianity. And today, we look forward, Josh, with you to exploring Balak and particularly your very innovative and exciting thesis around Balaam as the prototype of a Gentile seducer. Could you maybe explain more?
Sure. So this idea began really in my own special field, which is the study of New Testament. And I was reading as a graduate student the final book of the New Testament, the book of Revelation. And there's a very curious reference to Balaam in the early chapters of Revelation, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And I was curious about why Balaam was used there and how he was used there. And it opened up a whole new way for me to think about Balaam as he's described in the Tanakh. And then, of course, more importantly for me at least, how that character was received by Jews and early Christians in the late Second Temple period.
And it seems, just going into our parasha, that there are at least three Balaams, if that's right. Could you maybe expand on the different ways that we encounter Balaam in the parasha?
Sure, it's in this parasha, but it's also in a parasha down the road where Balaam will return. And it's actually that Balaam that I think has a bigger impact on the history of tradition. So in Parashat Balak, you have the story of Balaam being hired by Balak to go and curse the Israelites. But even in this portion, there are two very different pictures of Balaam. One is a Balaam who's a good guy, right? Balak goes to him and says, I'd like to give you wealth and power and all of this if you just go and curse the Israelites for me. And Balaam says, no, I can't do it. All I can do is what the God of Israel tells me to say. And he's pretty consistent in that position throughout. And so you would think that Balaam is, as one of the great Bible scholars of the 20th century called him, something of a saint. Right, a prophet who's willing to say, I won't take any money to do something that's against my conscience, and my conscience says, I say whatever God says about Israel. On the other hand, in Parashat Balak, there is this brief interlude, this weird little story, where Balaam seems to be dumber than his own donkey. So you know the story where he finally goes to curse the Israelites. And of course, he can't get through the pass because the angel of the Lord is there, but only the donkey sees it first. And it's only once Balaam's eyes are opened that he sees it. And Balaam comes off looking like something of a fool. Now, it's clear to what we would call source critics, people who read the Bible with the understanding that it is a compilation of sources that have been brought together, that the broader story of Balaam as a saintly prophet is from one hand. Traditionally, it's considered the E author. Whereas that little interlude is placed within the narrative and intentionally meant to mock Balaam and take away a bit of the luster from his reputation. And that is probably included by what's called the J author. But those are only two visions of Balaam in the Tanakh. If you go two parshiot later, past Pinchas and all the way to Matot. In Matot, you get this brief little reference to Balaam, which ends up becoming very significant. because in Parashat Matot, this is where we find out that God instructs the Israelites to wage war on the Midianites because of what happened after the Balak scene two parshiot ago. So you remember that after Bilam fails to curse, the Israelites have this festival with the Moabites and the Midianites, where they start getting it on with foreign women, and this is a great offense to God. And that leads to the story of Pinchas killing the two people in flagrante delicto. I don't know if that's a Latin expression that has made it into, in the middle of the act. And so two parshiot later, God decides to get vengeance against the Midianites. And God says there in chapter 31 of Numbers that it was Bidvar Bilam, by the advice or by the witting, or by the words of Bilam, that Balak decided to use Moabite women to corrupt the Israelite men. And it's that vision of Bilam, not as the saint, not as the hapless, stupid prophet, but as the enticer of the Israelites, the one who gave Balak the idea to use pretty ladies as a way of ultimately destroying the Israelites. It's that Bilam that really catches on in later tradition and turns Bilam into a bad guy.
Let's maybe turn to that. How is Bilam treated by later interpreters, and how maybe do they extrapolate those pictures that you present, those three distinct hats that we encounter in the book of Numbers?
So when it comes to the picture of Bilam as an accomplished saintly prophet, it has to be said that in Jewish tradition and even into rabbinic tradition, there are those who claim that Bilam was in fact a remarkable prophet. Indeed, according to some rabbinic traditions, a prophet who had skills in prophecy that surpassed even Moses. But on the whole, nonetheless, Bilam is seen as a negative character. So, for example, the reason why he is upbraided by God when he leaves on his she-ass and then has that whole episode is because later interpreters will assume that secretly Bilam wanted to curse Israel, even though he knew that God wasn't going to allow him to curse Israel. And so they're able to find a certain badness or flaw in Bilam's character in that scene. But again, by and large, most of the interpretations of Bilam in later tradition stem from that much later scene where Bilam is attributed with giving Balak the idea to corrupt the Israelites in Numbers 25 after the failed curse, that Bilam was the one who gave Balak the advice on how to corrupt the Israelites using women, which created the whole apostasy at Peor and ultimately led to a great plague against the Israelites and then ultimately the genocide against the Midianites in chapter 31.
Who would you associate Bilam with in terms of like other character references that we might draw from Tanakh? What kind of company does he have? What sort of genre is Bilam perhaps associated with?
There's a couple of characters that come to mind. One I had not anticipated talking about, but I think I will. The other is much easier. So one is Jethro, in the sense that Jethro is a non-Jew in the Torah with a particular talent and importance that plays a role in the development of Israel and is a good guy, even though he's not a part of the family, and and later Jewish tradition will have a hard time making sense of that kind of two-sided role of Jethro. And in many ways, Bilam plays the same kind of role as this remarkable prophet, but he's a Gentile and he refuses to curse Israel, but we think he also told Balak how to corrupt Israel. So there's that similarity. The other is a character that the book of Revelation will eventually compare Bilam to, and that is King Ahab's queen Jezebel. Because Jezebel, of course, will become famous as the great corrupter of Israel. Ahab marries this foreign queen. She brings with her devotion to foreign gods and goddesses. And that, of course, leads the Israelites into the worship of foreign gods and goddesses. And many later Jews will see Bilam in the same way, that here is this classic Gentile who finds a way to corrupt Israel by introducing them to a foreign god, this in this case, Baal of Peor, and getting them to apostatize against the God of Israel and start pursuing this foreign worship.
It's a theme that's cropped up, but it strikes me as interesting that the book of Bamidbar has more named after individuals than any other book. And I wondered, just as a slight digression, what your take on that might be.
I don't know. It may just be a coincidence that a lot of first sentences where the books break up happen to have the name of a person in them. But it's also because I assume that Bamidbar just has a lot of great stories, individual discrete stories about really interesting people like Korach, like Bilam and Balak, like Pinchas. These are just great stories. And so it would make sense that they are the individual units that we've broken off to read each week in the summer.
Going back perhaps now to your central thesis of Bilam as the prototypical Gentile seducer, I think you referenced in the introduction your reading of the book of Revelations, and perhaps you might go on to talk about John of Patmos and how he appropriates Bilam. What purposes does he use Bilam for?
Sure. So before I get into that, it's important to recognize that when John of Patmos, who I'll explain who he was in a moment, when he was writing in the first century, contemporary Jewish writers generally understood Bilam as a Gentile seducer who corrupted Jews. So if you look at the writings of Josephus or Philo or another author called Pseudo-Philo, all of them seem to answer the question, what did Bilam do wrong? With the following answer. They say, what Bilam did wrong is that after he failed to curse Israel, he told Balak to use pretty girls to lead Israel astray. In some way, use pretty girls as a lure, Israelite men will go after them, and then they will pursue Moabite women, and the Moabite women will be able to say, if you want me, first you have to worship my God. That was a standard view in the first century. So in the first century, there was a famous Christian who's often known as John of Patmos. So John of Patmos was a late first century Christian who found himself on the island of Patmos, and he wanted to write a message to his followers who were on the mainland of what is today Turkey. Patmos was an island off the coast of Turkey. But John of Patmos was a particular kind of late first century Christian. He was a kind of Christian who believed that Jesus of Nazareth had died and been resurrected, but nonetheless, he thought that nothing about Jewish life or observance ought to change. Yes, you are baptized into Jesus, you worship Jesus, but you also keep kosher, presumably marry other Jewish spouses, and you observe Shabbat and the holidays, and you avoid foreign worship of any other kind of God. You continue being Jewish, you just add Jesus to that worship. But at the end of the first century, he may well have been in a minority among Christians, the majority following the teaching most associated with the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul in the first century, mid-first century, said that, in fact, the implications of Jesus' death and resurrection mean that once you are baptized and become a Christian, you are no longer required to observe many of the basic rules of Jewish living. For example, eating only unkosher food, avoiding meat that had been slaughtered at a temple of a god like Asclepius or whatnot. But rather, you could live much more like a non-Jew would live on account of your now being Christian. And in the first century, there was actually a great conflict between these two Christian views. To what extent do the rules of Jewish life still apply? And my argument is that in the beginning of Revelation, what you see is that in many cases, the author of Revelation, John of Patmos, is yelling at the various communities that he used to live in on the mainland in what is now Turkey, in cities like Ephesus and Thyatira and Philadelphia. And he's telling them, here's where you've gone wrong. You've gone wrong because you've let the teaching of Jezebel turn you astray, or you've let the teaching of Balaam lead you astray. And what I have argued, and I'm not the first, is that what John of Patmos means to say is that you on the mainland, you have started following the understanding of Christianity created by Paul, where you are now eating unkosher foods. You're eating meats that come from temples where other gods are worshipped. And no honest to God Jew would do that. But someone, either Paul or Paul's successor in your community, has made you think that those kinds of things are okay. But in so doing, he has led you astray and turned you to idolatry. And in order to come up with a name for these people to make fun of them, instead of saying whatever their real names were, which was probably John, or it was a pretty common name back then, he gives them a nickname to make fun of them. He says, these prophets that are teaching you that Jewish law no longer matters, they're like Jezebel. They're like Balaam. They're trying to seduce you with the ways of the world, but ultimately that will corrupt you and lead you out of the Jewish fold. It's hard for people to hear that, to see Revelation that way, because we think of Revelation as a Christian text. And what this requires is for us to see the author of Revelation as actually what we might call an Orthodox Jew who's concerned that people are using their Christian faith to abandon the scruples of Orthodox Judaism.
Fascinating. And I'll certainly never read the book of Revelations the same again. Incidentally, you follow a number of others that have come up with this thesis. How has it been received, and how do you agree or maybe converge or diverge with others who have a similar opinion?
I don't know that I wouldn't say it's been well enough received that it's now the predominant position, but it's certainly not, it's not a position that would be considered out of bounds in the scholarly field. It's been embraced by significant enough scholars that I'd say it could be put in the mainstream. The problem is that it is what we would call, maybe you'd call it a mirror reading. In other words, unfortunately, we don't really know what was going on on the ground in those communities that the author was writing to. All we have is what the author says, and we have to try to look into that and see a reflection of what's going on in those communities. And those kinds of readings, I think, are always a little bit tentative, because until we find some piece of evidence that on the ground in the city of Philadelphia or Thyatira, there were in fact Pauline Christians who were trying to convince other Christians to start eating meat that had been sacrificed at the temple of Asclepius, and then someone else called them a Jezebel, until we find that corroborative evidence, we're only dealing with what can be at best speculative. And I think that will always be a thorn in the side of this interpretation. At the same time, someone has to explain why, of all the nicknames in the world, John of Patmos called his opponents there Jezebel and Balaam. And the link there is clearly that they are non-Jewish seducers who turn Jews away from their God.
Wonderful. Thank you, Josh. Thank you for sharing with us and also introducing a very different element to Between the Lines. So wonderful to have you, and we do look forward to welcoming you back.
It was an absolute pleasure. Anytime. Good luck.
Thank you. If you enjoyed this podcast, then please do remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, do find out all about our exciting content that we have for you on our mothership, jewishquest.org. And we do look forward to meeting again next week.